Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Hi, everyone. It's Doug Fabrizio. And as you probably know by now, KUER has been doing a mini fun drive here at the end of the year. So today on Radio West, we're going to carve out a little time to make our case. And as for the show itself, we're going to play parts of two of our favorite shows this year. The first was a conversation with the husband and wife research team Kelly and Zach Wiener-Smith about what it would really be like to live on Mars. Here's a spoiler. It will suck. An average temperature of minus 76 degrees, planet-wide toxic dust storms. The Wiener-Smiths say the technology looks solid. It's the squishy details of human existence that don't really pencil out yet. And then some of our conversation with the writer Catherine Rundle about her really graceful collection of essays on endangered animals. So stay with us. We'll be back after this. There's a compelling argument for trying to settle space, that it could be a refuge if climate change cripples the Earth, that it could end scarcity and unify us, make us wise. But in their new book, the husband and wife research team, Kelly and Zach Wiener-Smith, say, we haven't really worked through the details, that we're still in that fantasy myth phase of all of this. Like, we don't know for sure if people could make babies in space. And even if they did, we don't know if they could develop properly in a high radiation, high carbon dioxide atmosphere without Earth normal gravity. But set aside the biology questions for a second. The Wiener-Smiths say we haven't even worked out the economics or the sociology or the legal part of space settlement. They say the legal structures that govern space haven't been updated since the 1970s. And they say human spacefaring is almost always purely political. There's this weird little story in their book that illustrates this, where a Nazi soldier tries to Heil Hitler a penguin.
I was reading a book about Operation Deep Freeze, which is now mostly, you know, people don't remember. It was a late 1940s project by the United States, I think run by the Navy, to create the first permanent inhabitants of Antarctica. People had been going to Antarctica, I think, since the late 19th century, and the South Pole was reached in 1911. But it was always just sort of mad dashes or temporary encampments. This was like putting soldiers in giant fridges to see how they could set up tents and working out like eye gear and all the little details. And I came across this little reference to the time Nazis saluted a penguin, and as I recall, it was like not elaborated on. And you're like, how can you possibly bring this up without providing some additional detail? So I think Kelly found the paper, which was recalled, I think, in the 1960s about this attempt by a small group of Nazis on a boat. They showed up in Antarctica to stake a claim. It was going to be called New Swabia. I think that's the anglicization. It was going to be something like Nuge. I shouldn't even try to speak German, but
that's right.
Yeah, thank you. But so they literally, these Nazis show up, and the story recalled was that a penguin kind of waddles up, and just sort of reflexively being Nazis, one of them raises his hand and goes, Heil. And I'm not making this up. The document said something to the effect of the penguin being sort of unimpressed or impassive, which is, you know, the appropriate response to this sort of thing. But what's nice, of course, is it also tells you what it was like. You know, empires were trying to stake claims to this place, which is part of what necessitated a treaty system designed to keep peace between nations in the post-World War II era.
Yeah, at one point there were three nations with a claim on Antarctica, sort of like pizza wedge-shaped claims that were overlapping.
Well, they're still there.
Yes, and so these three claims still exist, but we have still somehow managed to peacefully do science and coexist on Antarctica without fighting. And it hasn't been like the capitalist dream with tons of resource extraction or anything like that, but we've managed to maintain the peace. So we think it's a helpful way to think about how space could go, depending on how we decide to manage it.
Because that is the point, right? I mean, we've got to sort of work this out before we jump into things, I guess.
We think so.
We would love to see it worked out before we get there, but one of the other nice things about Antarctica as a story is that things were already starting to heat up. There were already these overlapping claims, some shots had been fired, but we were all still able to, like, pull back from the precipice and figure out a way to do it peacefully. So we'd love to see us figure it out before people are starting, you know, for example, settlements on the moon. But we still have some, like, wiggle room to figure stuff out, but we think the sooner you start talking about it, the better.
Kelly and Zach Wiener-Smith. Kelly teaches at Rice University in the Biological Sciences Department. Zach is a cartoonist. Their new book is called A City on Mars. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So the Wiener-Smiths are kind of in a tough spot with a book that debunks many of the ideas about space settlement because they consider themselves bona fide space geeks. They're just skeptical space geeks. And Kelly told us when they first started writing the book, they didn't set out to be party poopers.
We began thinking this was going to be happening soon and that we would be writing the guide for, like, what are the near-term problems we need to solve as we take our first, you know, sortie to Mars. So the first trip to Mars where you then come back. And then as we build up to the stage of settlement, which we thought was going to happen in our lifetime initially. And part of why we thought that was because of research that we had done for our prior book, Soonish, which sort of introduced us to the space settlement community and some of the literature. And so we were sort of, as sci-fi geeks, we clung to this idea that, yes, settlements are coming. We're going to see this. You know, for over 100 years, people have been saying that, but now it will be true. And 2 years into the research, we changed our minds.
Yeah. So we'll get to the details here as we go, but we should maybe point out that you do think space settlement is possible. But as you say in the book early on, we have to know what we're getting into. We have to have these conversations about the truth and the reality of life in space. But you say we're not really doing that right now. We haven't really thought this through yet. Is that basically what you're saying?
I would add a slight nuance to that is a lot of like the sort of systems in terms of rocketry and engines have been thought about very deeply. Right. And there have been missions that are planned very deeply. The part that is often elided is everything we call squishy, right? So things like like all the biological effects are often kind of skipped over, like they're not a big deal by some advocates. Also, you know, reproduction paramount among them, and maybe we'll get to that. But even stuff like building an ecosystem in a sealed container is something we know very little about. And then beyond that, as you alluded to, creating legal structures that allow us to perform this expansion without threatening Earth, either through geopolitical tensions between nuclear powers or through simply enabling a large number of powerful countries and corporations and individuals to have the ability to move large, fast, heavy, dinosaur annihilating asteroid-sized objects around at will. We need a system that can handle all that stuff, and it's just off. That's the stuff where we say we have indeed not thought this through, at least among the primary advocates and like powerful billionaires.
What is it that space actually does to the human body? And maybe start with, as you write about this, the idea that all of the systems in our jiggly fluid based bodies evolved, as you say, in this environment where there's this 6 billion trillion ton sphere called Earth. So start there, like how we evolved, and then we'll sort of start working through the details about what it is that getting outside of this pillar of Earth means.
Yeah, so we evolved on this planet where we're all exposed to what we now call 1G, and our bodies are now used to having the cues associated with gravity. So, you know, when you step down, there's pressure on your bones and your muscle, and that pressure is important for making sure your bones stay strong and your muscles stay strong. And it's important, you know, your body has sort of acclimated to the fact that when you want blood to go down, you don't really need to do anything to make that happen. Mm-hmm. The blood just goes down because gravity helps you out. So when you go up to the International Space Station, for example, and you are in free fall all the time, you're not getting the benefit of that gravity. So instead of going down, blood tends to flow up. And that seems to cause some problems. So, you know, you have a face that looks puffy, and maybe that's bad for, like, social cues. Your face looks a little bit different. It's hard to read the cues. But it also appears to be bad for things like vision. And we're not 100% sure that the fluid shift is what causes vision changes, but we do know that astronauts tend to become more nearsighted the longer they spend in space. And we think that's because the fluid is putting pressure on the eyeballs and the nerves that go to the eyeballs, and it's just generally causing problems. So that's not great. We also know that that muscles deteriorate, and we know that bone deteriorates pretty quickly. And this is even with astronauts doing something like 2 to 3 hours of exercise, like 5 days a week. So astronauts lose something like 1% of the density in their hip every month. And most astronauts are only up there for 6 months to a year. And that's pretty quick bone loss. And so Mars has 40% of the gravity that Earth does. And so the big question is, how are our bones and our muscles going to handle that? Is 40% going to be enough to ameliorate the fact that our bones break down when you're not exposed to 1G? Or is it just going to slow things? Is it going to make that bone loss go down to 0.1%? Like, that sounds much better. But if that's every month, and now instead of a 6 month to 1 year stay, you're talking about developing and spending your entire life on Mars, it's hard to know how well our bones and our muscles are going to hold up.
One of the sections in the book is, where do we put people in space? And, ideally, we talk about the moon, we talk about Mars. But just say something about Mars, for example, because you say in the book how thoroughly, incredibly, impossibly horrible Mars is. So just how impossibly horrible is life on Mars?
Well, so you're probably not going to have a lot of windows because you're going to be worried about radiation. So you're going to be living under a giant pile of dirt. And that dirt has a lot of other problems. So that dirt is actually what's called regolith. And if you look at it under a microscope, it's a lot more sharp and jagged than the sort of dirt and soil that you find on Earth. So you're going to have to be particularly careful to not let it get into your habitat, because if you breathe it in, there's some concern that it will scar your lungs and cause what's called stone grinder's disease.
Wow.
Where basically lung scarring builds up over time and it's harder and harder to breathe. Additionally, that dirt has perchlorates in it. So this is a chemical that binds to your thyroid and messes up your thyroid hormones. And these hormones control things like blood pressure and heart rate. And we know that if you grow plants in soil that has perchlorates, those plants take up the perchlorates as well. So you're going to have to be careful to be removing perchlorates from your water and from your soil so that you're not, encountering these endocrine disrupting hormones over and over again. Mars has 1% of Earth's atmosphere, so that's thin enough that you can't go outside without suffering from something like decompression sickness, where you get bubbles in your brain and in your blood and you would die. So there's no walking around outside and feeling the wind on your skin or something like that. But Mars does have enough wind to kick up dust storms that can cover the entire planet and can last for weeks and can make it very dicey to be living off of solar panels. So probably we're going to have solar panels supplemented with some sort of nuclear power, which you'll need to, bury far enough away that you don't have to worry about radiation. And additionally, definitely SpaceX has gone a long way towards making things cheaper to deliver mass to low Earth orbit. Presumably, they'll get to Mars on Starship eventually. But it's still going to be really expensive to bring mass with you. So you probably shouldn't be expecting to live in giant habitats when you get there. So it's going to be cramped. There's going to be fear about, your habitat depressurizing, or, have we really figured out the radiation shielding yet? What is this lack of gravity, of Earth-like gravity, doing to my bones? But, on the other hand, Mars has water, and it has a day that's about as long as Earth's. That's nice. It's far enough away from Earth that communication is going to have something like a 3-minute delay, or maybe even as long as a 22-minute delay when Mars is as far as it can get from Earth. So you're not going to be able to have live phone calls with therapists back home or family back home. So you're going to be pretty reliant on the people that you went with. So that's a sampling of the struggles you'll have to work with on Mars.
You say this in the book. You say that if you could leave and build a new civilization, do you know what you'd do first? You'd start recreating Earth as we know it. What are you saying there?
You know, Earth has a lot of things that I think we take for granted. So international law doesn't do everything you want. You know, Russia did invade Ukraine. There were consequences, but the war is ongoing. Yeah. But, you know, we have made a lot of progress on human rights, and their international law has, you know, created a system where a bunch of us can bind together and, for example, sanction Russia for its bad behavior. And so, you know, we've got a lot of good things. You know, the World Health Organization helps you identify when there's an outbreak of a new zoonotic disease or something. We have a lot of institutions that improve our lives in a variety of different ways. And I think a lot of times when you imagine going somewhere and starting over, you just assume that you've taken all of the good with you and now you get to work on the bad. But you're probably going to need to create systems to recreate all the good things that we have here on Earth. And that's going to take time. And if you start from scratch, there's some chance you're, you know, going to mess that stuff up on the way. So I think people just maybe don't appreciate how great a lot of our institutions are, even if they're imperfect.
Can I just pile on that? Like a big part of what we're into is just this idea that, like, you know, a lot of the international law that has been built has been, you know, kind of wrested from our worst natures over time, right? We've been able to make a relatively peaceful world that relatively, maybe not as much as it should, but cares about the environment, cares about preserving peace, and a lot of people are just bored by it. They take it for granted. I think sometimes they're itching for change. They feel it's too bureaucratic and wimpy, and it's not sufficiently dynamic. And so they'll say, can we just trash all this and have something new? But you know, I think what you would find if people started a Mars civilization tomorrow is they would immediately be cribbing, if they were doing it right, from the documents we've created down here. And the better life we've created down here, when you compare it to what it was like for much of the 20th century, for much of the 19th century, for much of human history. We don't want to do without these things. They're not perfect, but they're really good compared to what we had before.
Toward the end of the book, you write about this anthem sung by Russian cosmonauts. I wanted to ask you about that finally, if I could, because the song refers to this dream that these explorers had, and it wasn't for, as they sing, icy blue space. It was for the green grass of home. Will you say something about that finally?
Sure. Yeah. So Zach and I love this song. It's like an 80s power ballad. and we dance to it at our house all the time. Huh. I should clarify that. So it is thought of as like the cosmonaut anthem. But I had the opportunity to speak to one cosmonaut. And when I asked him about it, he groaned. He was like, oh, everywhere we go, people play that song. Any like talk that you give, that's the song that plays when you walk in the room. He was definitely over it. But but the idea is that you go to space and, you know, you're surrounded by this sort of artificial environment, and what you end up missing are the smells of home, the sounds of home. You know, Zach talked about Terry Virts in his memoir how they miss the sound of rain. When you read astronaut biographies, when you read astronaut memoirs, they talk over and over again about how, like, when a resupply ship comes and you open it up and you smell the apples or you smell the lemons or you smell the onions, even. The Russians report loving the smell of the onions when they arrive. Like, just the smells and the sounds of home and the feeling of being able to, like, hug your loved ones that you've missed. This seems to be the things that astronauts report spending a lot of time thinking about and longing for when they're in space. The view from space is beautiful, but there's a lot to miss about home.
Kelly and Zach, thanks, guys, very much.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Kelly Wiener-Smith, she's an adjunct professor in the Biological Sciences Department at Rice University, along with cartoonist Zach Wiener-Smith, are co-authors of the book A City on Mars: Can We Settle Space? Should We Settle Space? And Have We Really Thought This Through? Today, during the show, the Bastion Foundation is matching your donation to KUER up to $7,500. You're going to hear from some people with more details about all of that here in a sec. Take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
As 2024 comes to a close, we at KUER need you to help us finish the year strong.
If you've been thinking about making your first ever donation, becoming a sustaining member, or just throwing in a little extra, now's the perfect time. Whatever you give funds the local journalism and statewide news coverage you've come to love and rely on from KUER. If you've already pitched in during our year-end fund drive, thank you. If you haven't and you're ready to do so, it only takes a few minutes. Head over to KUER.org and make your donation.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
Catherine Rundle is a literary prodigy and superstar. She's only 37, but already she's written an acclaimed biography of the poet John Donne, not to mention 10 children's books and one play. She's been compared to British fantasy writers like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. And last year, she wrote a book called Impossible Creatures about centaurs and sphinxes and krakens and dragons. But we wanted to talk to her about the real creatures in another of her books called Vanishing Treasures. It's a collection of essays about endangered animals. And her favorite, or one of her favorites, is the pangolin, which she says in the essay is more beautiful than seems plausible in this fallen old world.
I have never fallen in love at first sight with any human being, but I have once in my life, and it was with a pangolin.
To reach this particular pangolin was difficult, which felt only reasonable. Something so remarkable shouldn't be gained with ease. She lives in a wildlife conservation project outside Harare, Zimbabwe. The roads in Harare have been deteriorating for years. Gaps are patched with house bricks, and during the rains it would be possible to bathe a Great Dane in the potholes. Most of the road signs have long since gone. The rumour was that they were used for coffin handles during the cholera outbreak in 2008, although that's probably mostly apocryphal, and you drive by guesswork and hope. Hot pink and purple bougainvillea grow at the verge and occasionally overwhelm the traffic lights. You reach a wildlife conserve where there are two pangolins that are being protected day and night by their guards, men who follow them throughout the day, making sure that they are unmolested. They move from termite mound to termite mound. They need to eat an enormous amount. But the reason you fall in love is a pangolin looks ancient.
And they are, in fact, prehistoric. They are 80 million years old, in contrast to our 6 million. They were here first, at the origin of things. They have an ancient, unassailable, ungainsayable right to remain.
If you've never seen one, they look like an anteater. They are the sort of bluish green of the ocean on a cold day. And they have a tongue that is as long as their torsos that they keep furled up internally in a sort of pouch just in front of the hip. And they have the face of a kind of inquisitive, generous, polite academic. And the way they move, they walk on their hind legs and they sort of move their hands. If you were to anthropomorphize, you would definitely say either knitting or thinking about the chores you have to do that day. There is a real humanity to their faces. But they are also wild and strange. And I have never seen anything in my entire life so beautiful.
The Sangu peoples of southwestern Tanzania heralded the arrival of a pangolin as a great event. It was said in the folklore that they fall from the sky sent by the ancestors and follow home the first person they meet in the bush. If a pangolin did arrive at a person's home, it was treated with both respect and careful wariness. With songs, a slaughtered sheep, the pangolin clad in a black gown, and a ceremony that ended in dancing.
And they are also the most trafficked animal in the world. And so they are the thing that we owe our protection to and have failed to give it to. And, you know, the thing that haunts me is that we must take care not to lose them before we know them. They have a far more ancient right than we do to this earth. I know so many scientists who have dedicated their formidable, breathtaking intellect to knowing the living world, and yet the thing they are most eager to point out to us is how little we know. What we know barely touches the edges of a percentage of the truth. And so to think that we can safely discard any living thing because it's of no use to us, that in itself is mad, but even if you took out human self-interest entirely from the equation, the idea that there would be these creatures of infinite variety and infinite complexity, and we would think, just because we do not know, that they are expendable, that strikes me as one of the great stupidities of the world. We so rarely discover that we have overestimated the intelligence of something. We are almost always discovering that something is more complex, more strange, more vivid, more beautiful, more peculiar, more instinctive, more remarkable than we knew.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Catherine Rundle is with us. In her book, there are stories and meditations on lemurs and hermit crabs and elephants, bats, tunas, storks, many others. Rundle calls it a litany of creatures and the things we've always gotten wrong about them.
I guess the crucial misperception is that we think of all intelligence along the sort of measurement of human intelligence, and we have failed to understand that there are other forms of intelligence and other forms of knowledge. The way, you know, famously, the one everyone talks about is the octopus. That the octopus might have the same kind of, you know, profundity of intelligence as us, but just not comprehensible to us because in an entirely different sphere. But then also, when I say sort of a litany of mistakes, sometimes I mean also just the kind of the ways it reveals our very hopeful desires, that we hope that if we eat a specific kind of animal, maybe it will make us very good at sex, or that if we eat a specific kind of animal, it will keep us alive for vastly longer or give us vitality, things which almost never turn out to be true. I mean, you know, there's a list in the book of the things that we have thought are aphrodisiacs. The number of aphrodisiacs available to us in the natural world, which we could consume and would have that effect, zero. But we have suggested that, you know, beaver testicles might give you, you know, a fabulous level of profundity in your lovemaking. We often think, you know, tiger claws and rhino horn. Often because we tend to choose things when we're trying to imagine what might be aphrodisiacal, we tend to imagine things that are in some way connected to sexual organs, that look like sexual organs, like the oyster, or that are just very expensive.
I liked this question. Someone once asked you if you could have written this book, Vanishing Treasures, if you had been born in London. What do you think?
I have no idea what I said. I'm going to say, of course, because so much of Vanishing Treasures I have written from a position of ignorance. I have never seen a narwhal, and I expect never to see a coconut crab. I have seen a seahorse once only in my life. And so the way I begin these things is from a position of the things I long to know. I'm very lucky that because I have a fellowship at Oxford, many of my colleagues are scientists. And so I will begin with speaking to many scientists. I'll read a lot of monographs, a lot of really, you know, there's fantastic scholarly articles, and most of them are included in further reading in the book. But because the essays are quite short, usually around less than 2,000 words, I often want to have one story that will just, you know, grab you by the wrist, like the idea of, you know, the giraffe that walked into Paris and ate rose petals from the hand of King Charles X, or, you know, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who kept a wombat in his home and sometimes during dinner parties would try and lift this living and, you know, somewhat belligerent wombat into a great silver tureen in the center of the dinner table, which it didn't want to do. The idea that there's a seal that speaks English with a very strong Boston accent because it was taught to do so as a little pup. The idea of the ways that we have destroyed so much, but we have also adored so much. And I wanted to use that as well as a way of talking about the living world, because I think the thing we must never forget is we are the living world. Sometimes we draw a distinction and forget that we are nature. We are animals. We are an animal among many. And I wanted to write about how we, and as an animal, have, you know, imposed ourselves upon and tried to cherish living things.
Can we come back to the wombat? I loved this essay. Let's say a little bit more. You mentioned wombats. They're deceptive. They're tougher. They're braver. They're faster. They're quicker than they look.
Right. I mean, when we think of the wombat, we think of a sort of cheerful, rotund teddy figure. But a wombat, so the fastest recorded human foot speed is, of course, Usain Bolt. And that's a 100-meter sprint, which was, I think, 44.7 kilometers an hour. But that was just very brief. And, you know, he could only maintain that for 1.61 seconds. Yeah. A wombat over a bigger stretch could absolutely outrun him. So they are faster than us. And they have a thick layer of hardened skin along their rump, so that sometimes if they are, for instance, in a den and attacked by a fox, they can retreat into the fox and crush its skull against the sides of the den. So, you know, they have profoundly powerful behinds. And one of the things that everyone knows, of course, is that wombats are marsupials. And so the sort of embryonic joey, instead of popping out the top like a kangaroo baby, comes out between the mother's legs so that when it's digging, it doesn't fill the hole with dirt and suffocate the embryonic joey, which I just think is absolutely extraordinary. But also, as the book points out, it does make it look like the wombat is in labor for 8 months, which is why it was a kangaroo who got to be in Winnie the Pooh.
I guess the sad part of the story of the wombat is a familiar one. They were once seen as vermin or pests. They were slaughtered en masse. Now they're having to contend with the destruction of their native habitat. So they sadly fit in that vanishing category, I guess.
They do. And so, you know, the criteria for conclusion in the book is there a species or subspecies which is endangered? And as you can imagine, that narrows it down almost not at all. Mm. And so while the common wombat is sort of, you know, their numbers are dropping, all species of wombat are now protected. There is a subspecies, which is the northern hairy-nosed wombat, which is an extraordinary wombat. It has a sort of softer fur, a thicker fur, and an enormous silky nose and poor eyesight. So it sniffs for food in the dark. And it's one of the rarest land mammals in the world. At the moment, we're not entirely sure of the numbers, but it's probably around 249, 251 left on the planet. Mm.
The essay on the seahorse is great. As you say, seahorse is technically a fish, but then you write, so is a shark, and that doesn't tell you much.
Right, right. I mean, I've always been very insulted by the idea that the shark is a fish. I mean, I know it is, but it always just seemed confusing to me, like tomatoes being fruit. I love the seahorse. They are another one. We are used to the beauty of the seahorse, the idea that there is something so exquisitely delicate that it looks like it must have been, you know, invented. The idea that evolution could create something so crystalline and perfect is extraordinary to us. You know, it looks like it was invented by the finest artist in the world. And if we weren't used to them, you know, we would, the fact of them, you know, that the male seahorse gives birth and they, in order for the female to be creating more eggs and therefore to have more births this season, they gestate for a very short period of time, 2 to 6 weeks. And then it's like a confetti cannon goes off. So the seahorse sort of, there are videos of it. They sort of look like they're sneezing, convulsing. And then from the top of his womb, there's 1,000 tiny, minute seahorse fry erupt. And he, you know, he disappears on a cloud of his own young. Mm. And then they do very little parenting, because only 0.5% will actually make it into adulthood. But the female will immediately start making new eggs. And just, you know, it is an extraordinary thing. And then the way they dance.
Each morning, the two meet in the male seahorse's territory. As they near each other, their colours change, out of subtle camouflage shades and into vivid hues, brown into white, white into yellow. The seahorse has tiny cells, chromatophores, embedded in the skin, each containing liquid pigment. By contracting or expanding the chromatophores, different colours appear with different intensity, orange, pink, red, a little like playing a colour organ. They circle each other, newly bright. The male twists around the female, their tails entwine. As they move, they click at each other, one of two noises of which they're capable. The other is a minute guttural growl when threatened, so faint as to be almost inaudible to human ears. Then the female returns to her own territory until the next day, when they dance again. For writers, hermit types, and part-time misanthropes, this might sound an ideal marriage.
And then they are so delicate, and storms, as we get more of them, have started to erode their numbers. And of course, fishing is a huge threat to them, and their numbers are plummeting. But 12 are vulnerable, 2 are endangered, numbers are dropping by nearly 3/4 in 10 years in some places. So, you know, my feeling about them is, if you never heard of them, if someone explained them to you for the first time, these dancing, colour-shifting, yes, technically fish, the only reasonable response would be, to scream, to wake up and think about the seahorse and scream and then keep screaming until you went to bed and then wake up and do it again. And it's not practical, but it is what they deserve.
Could I have you tell one last story? You have an essay on humans in your book on vanishing treasures. And there's a story you tell about the sibling books. Do you mind telling that story finally?
I would love to. So this is a very old story. And it's a story that we loved it in England in the Victorian age. We used it for many of our morals. But it actually dates from, you can find it in Aulus Gellius in 177, in this era. And also in the late, great, great Douglas Adams's Last Chance to See. And it's based on the idea of a real, true happening. So the books are lost, but the tradition runs that in real life, an elderly sibyl, a prophetess, in around the year 500 BCE, offered the last king of Rome the chance to buy 9 books containing, you know, all that was unknown in the world. And I tell it in a slightly, fictionalized and with some leeway given. But my version goes like this. So once upon a time, there was a great city and citizens leading busy lives. And into that city, one spring came an old woman. And with her, she had 9 books containing all the wisdom and knowledge, all the as yet unknown wonders and secrets of the world itself. And she said she would sell 9 books for the price of 1 large sack of gold. And the townsman said, well, that's ridiculous. That's an absolutely insane amount of money. In Aulus Gellius, he doesn't actually say a sack of gold. He says an exorbitant sum. And they say, take your books and leave. And she said, of course, as you wish. But first, she burns 3 of the books in the town square. And she, you know, goes on her way with the smoke of those secrets of the world as yet unknown still in the air. And it's a bad winter, and there's flooding and storms. But the citizens, they still thrive, more or less. And she comes back in the summer, and they say, you know, how are you? How's the undiscovered secrets of the known world going? And she says, fine, and she'll sell them the 6 books, 2/3 of all the world's wisdom and delight. But the price is now higher, it's 2 sacks of gold. And the citizens say, well, that's completely outrageous, that's profiteering. Absolutely not. And so she says, fine, and she signs three more books up in flames. And the next winter is much harder, and it's colder, and there are more deaths than people can really easily bear. But, you know, spring comes and people try to forget. And so when she comes back with the three books and says that they can have them for 4 sacks of gold, the people are uneasy now and they say, well, look, wait. Obviously, we can't give you 4 sacks of gold. That's insane. We don't have that. But leave the books and we'll maybe, you know, form a think tank or a committee and we'll let you know at some unspecified point in the future if there is something in them. But leave the books. And she says, can I have some firewood? And they say, we need the books. And she says, well, there is a price. And they say, we cannot pay it. So she burns 2 more of the books and leaves. And when she comes back, it's been a very bleak winter and the people are waiting for her. And they've done the maths. They've worked out it doubles every time. So they have the 8 sacks. And as she comes up with the one book, they say, we're ready. And she says, the price now is 16 sacks of gold. And they say, but we have planned and costed for 8. And she says, 16, you don't understand, is cheap. It is gold beyond all gold, these books. And the citizens run away to their homes and they fight and argue and people fall out and families divide. But they bring the sacks of gold. They bring her the 16 sacks and they seize the final last book just as she is putting it onto the flames. And the woman says nothing. She loads up her sacks and she leaves the city. And they have this final book and they call after her, it had better be worth it. And she says, of course it is. Of course it is gold beyond all gold. It is the untold wonders of the world. It is the secrets and glories. And she goes on and then she turns at the gate and she says, you should have seen what was burned. And I feel we're not quite at the final book, but our job, being alive now in this particular moment, none of us asked to be alive at this particular epoch, but here we are. And so our job is to fight, to keep as much as humanly possible from the flames.
Catherine Rundle, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Catherine Rundle, she's a fellow at All Souls College, Oxford. Her book is Vanishing Treasures, A Bestiary of Extraordinary Endangered Creatures. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we're on YouTube at KUER90.1 and Instagram at Radio West. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.